Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that spent half a century buried alive. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, where we keep the old stories warm. And this one, well, this one starts cold. About as cold as it gets. Picture the Greenland ice cap. 1942, a white nothing that stretches to every horizon, wind screaming across it, and somewhere up in that gray soup, 8 American warplanes are lost and running out of fuel. We'll get to how they got there, and we'll get to the part where, 50 years later, a handful of stubborn men decided that one of those airplanes was going to fly again. Before I do, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, if there was ever a segment about a story worth keeping in your pocket, it's this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back. It's the summer of 1942, and the United States is scrambling to get airplanes to England. The Battle of the Atlantic is a meat grinder. German U-boats are sinking cargo ships faster than we can build them, and shipping a fighter across the ocean in a crate at the bottom of a freighter is a good way to feed it to a torpedo. So somebody looks at a map and has an idea. What if we just fly them over, short hops, Newfoundland to Greenland to Iceland to Scotland, stepping stones across the top of the world? They called it the Snowball Route. Now here's where it gets interesting. To do it, they'd send the fighters over in the company of bombers for navigation. The fighters of the day didn't have the range or the fancy gear to find a speck of a runway in the North Atlantic on their own, so the plan was, tuck the little airplanes in behind the big ones and let the bomber crews do the map work. This particular flight was 2 B-17 Flying Fortresses and 6 P-38 Lightnings. 8 airplanes. They lifted off bound for a base in Greenland, the crews knew only as Bluey West 1. If you've never seen a P-38 Lightning, let me paint it for you. Twin booms running back to twin tails, a little pod in the middle where the pilot sits, and 2 Allison engines snarling out front. The Germans called it the fork-tailed devil. It was fast, it was mean, and it was beautiful in the way that only a 1940s fighter can be. Polished aluminum, a canopy like a jewel, and a growl you felt in your chest before you heard it in your ears. 6 of them, that day, flying formation with 2 bombers over the loneliest water on Earth. And then the weather closed in. You have to understand what that meant back then. No satellite pictures. No Datelink weather on a glass panel. No GPS whispering your position to a tenth of a mile. You had a compass, a clock, a chart, and whatever the last fellow told you before you took off. When the forecast was wrong and up there it was wrong all the time, you flew straight into it and hoped. They flew straight into it, a wall of cloud and snow, the kind of whiteout where the sky and the ground are the same color and your own instruments are the only thing telling you which way is up. They got turned around. Bluey West 1 radioed that the weather was too bad to land. Turn back, they said. Go back to Iceland. So they turned. And now they're low on fuel, over the ice cap in a storm, and the needles are creeping toward the pegs. The flight leader made the only call he had left. We're putting them down on the ice. Think about that decision for a second. You're a fighter pilot. You've got a broken country of blue-white ice under you, crevasses you can't see, sastrugi, those frozen wind-carved ridges hard as concrete. And you've got to set down a fast, heavy fighter with a tricycle gear that wants to dig in and flip you over.
The first P-38 to try it put the wheels down. And just like they feared, the nose wheel bit into the snow, and the airplane went right up on its nose, almost over onto its back. The pilot climbed out shaken, but alive, and he got on the radio to the others. Don't lower your gear, belly it in, land on the skin. And that's what they did. One by one, 6 P-38 Lightnings and 2 B-17s slid onto the Greenland ice cap on their bellies, throwing up great sheets of snow, groaning to a stop out there in the white. And here's the part that matters. Every single man walked away, 25 airmen, not a fatality among them. But now they're down, on the ice cap, in the winter that's coming. Pour yourself another cup, because the survival story alone would fill a segment. They stayed with the airplanes at first because that's what you do, and because those aluminum fuselages were the only shelter for 100 miles. It was brutal. The temperature fell and fell. They burned what they could. They melted snow for water. Rescue teams tried to reach them over the ice, on foot and by dog sled. And the crevasses nearly killed the rescuers too. It took the better part of 2 weeks, but they got every one of those 25 men off the ice and home. The airplanes, they left behind. Eight machines sitting on the cap, canopies frosting over, engines ticking as they cooled for the last time. Everybody figured that was the end of it. Snow would cover them by spring. And it did. Now most stories about airplanes lost in wild country end right there. A footnote, a wreck nobody ever sees again, but this one doesn't end there because some folks just could not let it go. Fast forward, 1980, a group of aviation history buffs and warbird hunters get the notion that those airplanes are still up there, and that a P-38 Lightning, one of the rarest, most sought-after warbirds in the world, might be recoverable. They started calling it the Lost Squadron. They figured it'd be easy. The airplanes went down on the surface, right? Just fly up, brush off the snow, and there they'd be. Here's where the ice cap teaches you humility. They mounted expedition after expedition through the 1980s. Radar, magnetometers, the works, and the airplanes weren't there. Not on the surface, not near it. Because in the decades since 1942, the snow hadn't just covered them. It had buried them. Layer after layer, packing down into ice, the whole glacier flowing and thickening on top of them year after year. When they finally got a solid hit with the radar and started to understand how deep it was, the number stopped them cold. 268 feet. Let that sink in. The airplanes were under 268 feet of solid ice. That's deeper than a football field is long, standing straight up. Half a century of Greenland winters stacked on top of those lightnings like a mountain. Most sane people would have quit right there. You cannot dig 268 feet through glacial ice with a shovel. You cannot blast it, not without shredding the very thing you're trying to save. So they came up with something a little bit crazy. They built a machine they called the Gopher. A great big brass cone with hot water piped through it, hung from a derrick. You lower it onto the ice. The hot water melts a hole straight down, and you keep lowering as the shaft opens up beneath you. A well drilled with heat instead of a bit, going down and down toward an airplane nobody had seen since Roosevelt was in the White House. Down they went, 100 feet, 150, 200. And then at the bottom of that steaming shaft, a boot touched metal. They'd found her. Now here's where it gets interesting, and where your heart breaks a little. The first airplane they reached down that shaft, they came at it, and the ice had not been kind. All those years and all that pressure, hundreds of feet of glacier bearing down had crushed it. One of the B-17s and some of the Lightnings were flattened, mangled, folded up, half a century under a mountain of ice does that. But then they melted their way to another one, a P-38 Lightning tail number sitting quiet in the dark. And this one the ice had spared, squashed a bit, sure. The tail booms bent, panels crumpled, but whole recoverable. So now picture the job. You've got an airplane the size of a fighter at the bottom of a 268-foot ice. Well, barely wide enough to stand in. How in the world do you get it out? You melt a room, that's what they did. Down at the bottom, they used that hot water to carve out a great cavern in the ice around the airplane, a chamber deep in the glacier, and they went to work in it, men in that blue-lit ice cave, hundreds of feet below the surface, taking a Lightning apart piece by hand. An engine here, a boom there, a wing section. Each piece hauled up that narrow shaft to the daylight and the wind. They brought her up in 1992. 50 years almost to the month after she went down, and then came the part that separates the dreamers from the doers, because pulling a crushed, corroded, 50-year frozen fighter out of a glacier is one thing. Making her fly again is another thing entirely. They trucked and shipped the pieces back to the States, down to Kentucky, and a team went to work on a restoration that would run for the better part of a decade. Now I've stood in restoration shops, and I want you to smell it with me. The bite of aircraft dope and primer, hot metal, cutting oil, that particular tang of old aluminum being coaxed back to life, rivet guns hammering away like a heartbeat. Men bent over jigs at midnight because they just couldn't leave it alone. They straightened those bent booms, they rebuilt the structure. They got two Allison engines turning again, every gauge, every cable, every fastener either restored or remade to match. It was less a repair than a resurrection. They named her Glacier Girl. And in October of 2002, on a field in Kentucky, with a crowd holding its breath, a P-38 Lightning that had spent 50 years entombed under 250 feet of ice ran up those two engines, rolled down the runway, and lifted off into the sky. I've heard from people who were there that when those Allisons came alive and she broke ground, grown men just wept because it wasn't supposed to be possible. The ice was supposed to have won. It had every advantage. Time, weight, cold, patience. And a bunch of stubborn people with a hot water drill and a dream said, "Not this time." Glacier Girl flew the airshow circuit after that, polished up, gleaming, that fork-tailed silhouette back where it belonged. People who'd only ever seen a P-38 in a photograph got to stand on the ramp and hear one, feel one, watch one bank against the clouds. Now let me tell you why this one sticks with me.
Because it's easy to hear a story like this and file it under nice and move on, we lose airplanes. We lose them to accidents and to the smelter and to simple neglect, to the passage of time and the shrinking of budgets. There's a part of me, and if you've listened a while, you know it, that gets grumpy about how much of our heritage we let slip away. How many warbirds got chopped up for scrap because somebody decided they weren't worth the hangar space, and then something like Glacier Girl comes along and reminds me that the old iron is never quite as gone as you think. Somewhere out there under the ice, under a farm field, in the back of a barn at the bottom of a lagoon, there are airplanes waiting. And as long as there are people willing to melt a 268-foot hole in a glacier to get one back, we haven't lost a thing that we truly wanted to keep. That's the real payoff of this tale, not the airplane. The people, the 25 who walked off the ice in 1942, and the ones 50 years later who wouldn't let her stay buried. My thanks to the folks who documented the Lost Squadron expeditions and the Kentucky Restoration crew who put her back in the air, and to the historians of the Snowball Route who kept the 1942 flight from being forgotten. You can find us anytime at RadioHanger.com. Pull up a chair whenever you like. The coffee's always on.
Next time you see a warbird on the ramp, walk up and put your hand on it. Somebody fought like the devil to keep it flying. This is Taildragger, wishing you tailwinds and soft landings.